It's the My Michelle Live podcast.
My Michelle Live, Sci Tech Talk, taking the God story to a geeky place. Here's Michelle.
Thank you, big voice guy. That's kind of funny. Taking the God story to a geeky place. Yeah, I guess we kind of are. Look, this is an interesting topic that we're taking on today. My Michelle Live delves into science on Tuesdays, and we'll do news and views, entertainment, sports, and so many other things. But our stint is looking for the God story. Is there a God? If there is, can we really see signs of him? And what does he expect of us, right? Right now, we're in the midst of a global panic, a global crisis, you may say. And it's not really the first time, right? I mean, the world's seen catastrophes. It has seen plagues before. There is, however, this story. It's usually told to kids, and it's painted in cute little boats and animals pairing up and walking into the ark. It's interesting. It's always been a little interesting to me that what could be considered the most devastating global catastrophe is something that we put in cute little banners and posters in kids' rooms. This is a catastrophe. The Ark, Noah's Ark. Now, critics claim that there are major problems with taking the Noah's Ark story literally. You know, getting all of those animals on a boat. God killing off most of mankind. Nice. And even deeper, we're going to talk about this story. If the Bible doesn't even get it right, what else can you not trust? I mean, what can you trust the Bible on? And that comes down to something we talk about a lot, your worldview. Your worldview matters. But if your worldview is built on something that's just not right, well, you might want to examine your worldview, right? There is a new story as well that leads credence to the critics that the Bible borrowed this idea of an ark from a Greek legend. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what some of the problems with the ark are. And we're going to ask the hard questions. If you're a believer, if you've got faith, then don't be afraid to have that faith challenge, because if God's God, he can take the heat. And I'm going to say that my guest, Bodie Hodge, probably agrees with me. God can take the heat, Bodie, right?
Yeah, he sure can. That's not a problem for an all-powerful God. I don't think God has lost an argument yet.
Well, we're gonna give him what we would hope a run for his money. I don't think God will all be altered. But, you know, for those of you who have been considering, is there a God? This Noah story is, it's an issue. Now, Bodie Hodge joins us today, and let me just give you a little background into our friend here. He is an author, he's a speaker, he's on staff at Answers in Genesis, intimately involved in the Creation Museum, where they even have an Ark encounter. So who better to take this issue on with? He's the author of some pretty spectacular books. In fact, one comes to mind, Bodie, Attacks on Biblical Truth. You're not a stranger to taking on some of the hard questions. So I'm delighted that you could be here today.
Hey, it's great to be back on with you. Kind of exciting. Actually, I love the topic that you've got today. So pretty excited.
All right. Well, you know, this is one of the biggest laugh at the Bible stories and, you know, scoff at the Bible stories that's out there. Noah's Ark. And now, there's been talk and there's been writings about Noah's Ark actually just being borrowed. Like everything else seems to come from Greek something, from the Greek word, from the Greek tradition. And now, you know, even the Bible is borrowing from Greek. Come on.
You know, if people would actually do their research for 30 minutes, they'd be able to realize that that's not the case. You know, I mean, I oftentimes hear that, oh, well, the Bible borrows from the Greeks or the ancient Near East or the Egyptians. But really what it is these guys have accounts of the flood. These guys have accounts of a Noah figure. And we expect to find out that's actually a good confirmation of scripture. The difference is the Bible records the true account by the power of the Holy Spirit through Moses. Now, what happened? How is it that the Greeks have an account, or the Babylonians have an account, or the Chinese? You realize people all over the world actually have these accounts. Well, it's because the actual event did happen. And as it passed down through all these different generations, all these different cultures, well, of course, they're going to have a flood legend. The difference is they're not going to get it right. They're going to substitute different names or mountains or places where they live. They're going to mess up the account. They're not going to get the shape of the ark quite right. And now they might be able to retain certain details here and there, but they're not going to have the true account the way the Bible is.
All right. Bodie, I think that is a fascinating idea, because if the Bible is true, what you're saying makes perfect sense. But what proof do we have of that? Now, I would add to the argument, well, the Greeks aren't the only society with an account of a catastrophe involving world flooding and the salvation of mankind through a unique means.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, for years, I would say that there was somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 300 flood legends around the world in different cultures. Now, I've been working with an expert, Nick Liguori. Nick Liguori has been trying to document every single flood legend in the world. And he has published his first volume. It's called Echoes of Ararat. So I'm going to kind of show you this book, Echoes of Ararat. Now, this first volume just looks at North and South America. And there are over 300 flood legends just in North and South America. So that's not even getting to Europe or Africa or Asia or all these other places where we already know that there's quite a few in those places as well. So he's working on all those. Now, that's pretty exciting. Now, I actually wrote a book. Now, this one here, it's a beautiful book. He's got all these different accounts and runs through them, ever so briefly, sometimes quoting them. Now, I did one that was actually more for families, a lot of fun one. Now, it's called The Flood of Noah.
Yeah.
I'm going to show that one up here just a little bit. Laura Welch and I put this one together. Bill Looney did the illustrations, and it is a fascinating book.
That's such a beautiful book.
You get to see all these different accounts. It's got flips and opens, all these different names for Noah, all these different names for Noah's wife, and all these different cultures. And it is a fascinating resource. So I absolutely love looking at this kind of thing. Do I expect to see the Greeks have one? Yeah, I sure do. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if there's several different Greek ones floating around out there, but one of them definitely hit the news here recently.
Yes, it did. And yet, I'm going to just tell you one of my pet peeves of the recent maybe decade is that when something hits the news, back in my day when I first started broadcasting, it was such a badge of honor when they didn't know where you stood on an issue, where you researched the issue to make sure that it was true, and you looked for the counterpoints and to see if there's more information out there to lead to the story. Now it's just about get it, report it, get it on, make it sensational. If it bleeds, it leads, and then move on to something else without any accountability. And we've seen that a lot throughout this pandemic, especially.
Yeah, in fact, you nailed the right word there, sensational. They want to be able to sell magazines or sell, time on the internet. It's kind of money driven. So they want the sensational headline. They want to be able to grab people and then move on to go to the next sensational thing. So you're right. A lot of people, they don't report the way they should report. And one of the things that I like to do, and I know a lot of different researchers here at Answers in Genesis, we want to go back. Let's go back and look at these original accounts. Let's analyze a little bit further. Let's go into the details about it. And let's look at it a little bit better. And let's have an honest assessment of what we've got here, whether it's a flood legend, whether it's an account of the Tower of Babel or whatever it might be. Let's document it and let's try to do it right.
Yes. Well, let's take on, for the sake of argument, I am absolutely going to ask these questions because, I want to know. And again, this is important beyond just a story in the Bible. This goes down to worldview. If the Bible can't be trusted on Noah's Ark, then what else can't it be trusted on? Maybe it has some nice little anecdotes and it can make us feel good or have some really good ideas, but so do a lot of other things. But if it is indeed true, defying even what modern critics would say, then like all the other truths that seem to come exploding out of the Bible in science, you've got to go, wait, there's something going on here. There's something deeper. So taking on some of the criticism of this story, number two, in importance, Bodhi, I think it's really important in this age that we learn to question. We have surrendered our ability to question and said, well, we're just going to trust that. That guy's going to tell us the truth. You know, if God says, right, come, let us reason together, test me, try me, prove me. If God's not afraid of question, then by golly, there better not be a man standing today that says, nope, just take my word for it. This is it. And we shouldn't be afraid to question. So question number one, Mr. Bodhi Hodge, the ark was built, and the Bible accounts that there was no rain. It was like, whoa, what's this stuff falling from the sky? That seems a little bit unlikely. Now, we do know that the Bible says that there was a cloud covering over the earth, and so there may have been differing conditions over the earth. From what we know in science, can you shore up that idea that there was a cloud covering, that somehow they broke and there was rain for the first time?
Well, you know, I know different creationists actually debate over that particular subject. Was there rain before the flood? Was there not? There's actually a lot of Christians on both sides of that.
Interesting.
I think there's a lot of confusion over, because in Genesis chapter 2, when it's looking back on the account of creation and it's talking about, that original perfect creation, you know, there was no rain at that point. There was no one to work the field. The waters came up out of the ground and was watering it, little springs, things like that. Now, the problem is some people take that and they presume that moved forward, just because we don't see any examples of the Bible talking about rain until the time of the flood. Although we have to be very careful of that, because remember, there was no man to work the ground either. And yet we know that God created Adam, then he made Eve, and so then they move forward. They're able to work that ground now. So there were some changes going on from Genesis chapter 2. We had the fall in Genesis chapter 3 where God cursed the ground. So things changed. So there might have actually been rain before the flood, but definitely not rain like what we saw right here at the flood. This was it was a different word that they actually used for the deluge. I mean, this is something massive. It's not used elsewhere in the Old Testament.
Okay. Let me just say, I live in Seattle. So understanding a dozen different words for rain, honey, you got me. I get it.
You guys got it. I'm telling you. Oh, my. But yeah, I mean, with the flood, this was some serious rain. The springs of the great deep burst forth. The windows of heaven were opened up. You know, that could have been, massive amounts of clouds. That could be figurative. You know, people still debate over that one as well. But either way, it was raining like what we would say, cats and dogs.
Yeah.
And it did it for a long time. You know, we have the 40 days and nights. That's really just the initial rain in the flood. That's when the ark raises up on those 40 days. And then the rain continues all the way up to the 150th day. That's when God first stops that rain. And we see that prevailing stage of the flood start to turn around and go the other direction.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was a massive event. You know, we actually find an incredible amount of evidence for the flood. Out of all these different aspects and elements throughout the Bible, the flood is probably the one that we have arguably the most evidence for. And here's why I say
that. Whoa.
Let's hear it.
Are you kidding me? Come on. You know, this is one of the most disputed, one of the biggest stories that people say, you know, Noah's Ark. Story done, Bible not true, move on next. And you're telling me the ark story and has more evidence than pretty much anything else.
Yeah, here's why I'm going to say that.
Bring it.
The rock layers that contain fossils, the vast majority of those are from the flood of Noah's day. And we're in a culture where people don't realize that. So they're looking at all this, they're walking around on this evidence, they're digging in it. The coal that we dig out of the ground, this is from the flood of Noah's day. These rock layers from Cambrian, literally all the way up to things like the Eocene and the Miocene, these were laid down in the flood of Noah's day. Noah's floating around up above it when these rock layers are being laid down. So we find these all over the world. Some of them are miles deep. It's all over the place. And that is evidence of the flood of Noah's day. That's what we expect to find in a worldwide global flood over the course of about a year. We expect to find billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. So, boom, there it is. It's right there. We're walking around on it.
And yet we have attributed that to some kind of global devastation. We don't know what. Could it be, you know, part of the Ice Age? Could it have been part of meteors hitting the Earth? You know, what happened to the dinosaurs?
Right.
That's another interesting question. Could a global flood have wiped out the dinosaurs, and why didn't the dinosaurs make it through Noah's ark? You know, he was like, yeah, no dinosaurs. I mean, was that like speciesism? We don't take your kind here.
Well, here's the thing. All the land-dwelling, air-breathing animals died by the 150th day of the flood. So, I mean, they were all dead. All the dinosaurs were running around at that point. They're dead. They're laid down in rock layers. We named those three rock layers Cretaceous, Triassic, and Jurassic Rock. So that's where those are pretty much buried at. Now, were dinosaurs on board Noah's Ark? Yes, they were. Now, I know as soon as I say that, we probably have listeners out there going, okay, dinosaurs, Noah, living at the same time. Let's back up for just a moment. Dinosaurs are land animals. They were made on the sixth day of creation. Not a problem for an all-powerful God. Okay. Man was made on the sixth day, so they lived at the same time. That's a new idea to a lot of people because most people, like me, went through a state school system. We've been to the secular museums. We watched these secular videos that are all over the internet or that we were shown in schools that told us that dinosaurs died out millions of years ago. So those are actually competing worldviews. They're two different worldviews. I want people to realize we're looking at the same evidence. We're looking at the same rock layers. The difference is the interpretation of those rock layers. Those rock layers were laid out at the time of the flood. Yes, the dinosaurs that were land-dwelling, air-breathing, they were on board the ark. Noah most likely took the juveniles, the smaller ones. They easily fit on board the ark. If you do the calculations, they came off the ark and they've died out for the same reasons that everything else is dying out.
I have a question as well. Now, there have been, beyond creationists, there have been secular scientists that have said that the atmosphere of the earth has changed in its development. And thus, there is evidence of what's called giganticism. I'd like your thoughts on that, because giganticism is this idea that things were bigger back then for some reason. There you go, just like Bode. Let's just reference the Bible. If man lived to be 900 years old, then animals lived to be hundreds and hundreds of years old. And interestingly enough, when you're looking at a certain species, they never stop growing their development. So that gives an interesting look into not only dinosaurs, but an understanding of maybe them being interactive with man. That's the first question. And the second part is, yeah, but we know that man and dinosaurs didn't coexist.
Okay, let's go to that first one. When it comes to gigantism, okay, we have all sorts of examples of different creatures that live pretty good size. In fact, the largest creature that ever lived currently lives today, and that's the blue whale. You know, it's a massive creature. But we do see some pretty big, we see, you know, big dragonflies. We see large mammals. Some are almost the size of like a Volkswagen Beetle, you know, some of these just different mammals that you would not expect to be that big. Dinosaurs are a great example of that. And you know what? Things going back closer to a perfect world, you know, we expect things to work a little bit better. Their genetics were probably better. They could have had perhaps more variability before the flood. After the flood, we only had a limited number, and only a certain number of those genetic traits survived through the flood on board the ark. So, you know, we might have more limitations. You know, you're right. There are certain animals, certain species. Think of a lot of reptiles. you know, they'll just grow throughout the duration of their whole life. You know, if they lived a lot longer, they could get a lot bigger. So, you know, there is that possibility on certain creatures as well. But, you know, it comes down to genetics and genetic bottlenecks. Now, think of something else. You know, dragonflies are a good example. You know, some of these dragonflies, I mean, they're literally like huge. They were big in the fossil record. We actually have an example of one here at the Creation Museum on display. So I look at that and I'm like, okay, I'm used to these little dragonflies. But here's something to think about. You know, the world before the flood and the world after the flood were very different. The world before the flood was a lot warmer. People, you know, if you think about Adam and Eve, God told them to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and they didn't wear clothes. They should have been able to fill the whole earth, their descendants, without wearing any clothes. That's a lot better climate if you just think about it. So even after the curse, you know, the world was more conducive to a better climate. Now we have what we call more extremes. We've got a lot more high mountains. Things have shifted around. Continents have shifted. And now we get more extremes, a lot more cold, a lot more super hot, dry areas, things like that. We're much more limited to a certain degree. Now think of something like that dragonfly. That thing comes off. It needs to grow really big before it lays eggs. Guess what? Winter is going to come before it gets a chance to mature to be able to lay those eggs. So the ones that are going to survive are going to be the ones that are smaller that get to a big enough size to lay their eggs to keep going. The bigger ones aren't going to survive before it gets cold in a lot of areas. So you can just see how some of that gigantism can actually be removed from the genetic population. But even after the flood, we do see examples of some giant creatures. You know, there were some pretty good sized mammoths. Think of Goliath. you know, I mean, there were a lot of giants in the land of Canaan. Even Moses denoted it that way, the land of giants. So, I mean, we even see it within the human population to a certain degree as well. Okay, let's move on to the second question, because that's the big one, humans and dinosaurs. You know, I actually wrote a whole chapter on did humans and dinosaurs live together? And of course, when you start with God and his word, they were both made on the sixth day. That's not a problem. Now, we see a lot of confirmations of that. In fact, the word dinosaur, a lot of people don't realize this. Dinosaur is a new word. It actually defines dinosaurs in a particular way. They are land reptiles that have one of two hip structures so that it raises its body up off the ground. So if it stands erect, then it is a dinosaur. That's why things like crocodiles, they're not considered dinosaurs because their legs come out to the side and their belly naturally rests on the ground. So dinosaurs are uniquely defined, but it's a new word. Nobody would use the word dinosaur until about the 1840s. In the 1840s, that's when they came up with it. It means terrifying or terrible lizard. But what were dinosaurs called before that? In cultures all over the world, what would they have been called? If somebody would have seen one, what would they have called it? Well, the most common answer is dragon. Dragon is an ancient name. We even find the word dragon is in the King James Old Testament 22 times. It's in the old Geneva Bible 24 times. So it's all over back there. It's two different words that the Hebrew translators, you know, into English or various languages translated.
And culturally, we see the word dragon throughout many, many completely separate cultures.
Absolutely. All over the place, from China to South America. We see it in the Middle East. We see it in Europe. It's all over the place. We see examples of these creatures being considered real creatures right alongside other creatures. The ancient flag of Wales, they still use it today, has a dragon on it. The old Chinese flag had a dragon on it. It's more of a long, slender dragon. They're different dragons, but they were still dragon creatures.
Perhaps so when you saw a dinosaur, you'd have,
Just called it a dragon. So, I mean, yeah, we see a lot of examples of this throughout history, where they were recorded either as a petroglyph or a scientist has analyzed it or it's mentioned right there among these other creatures, where these creatures looked a lot like what we would call dinosaurs that people had drawn.
Okay, and I have come across in my years some really stunning, hard, you can put your hand on it, evidence. And I remember, I think it was around 2005 when Mary Schweitzer of North Carolina State University found collagen fibers in a fossilized leg bone. And I wanted to say it was from a T-Rex. So I seem to remember it was by accident that they had a T-Rex bone. Yeah, the monster. And it they couldn't get it out of the site, so they had to break it. And in breaking it, they saw, you know, this is soft tissue. And so they're stunned. How could soft tissue be in something that is, you know, millions and millions and millions of years old? Could T-Rex have been existing in the time of man? I mean, this is like, wow. Tell me from a scientific point of view, not a Michelle point of view, what this means.
Right. You would have thought those researchers would have said, wow, maybe this thing isn't as old as I've been led to believe. But they didn't do that. Instead, they just like, oh, wow, I guess red blood cells and this soft tissue really can last 65 to 68 million years old. But, you know, a lot of people now have cracked open dinosaur bones. I know some creationists that cracked open a triceratops horn, and they found soft tissue in there as well. They even found crystalline material inside of a vein. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, thinking about that from a biblical viewpoint, it makes sense of this. If these things were buried a matter of thousands of years ago in the flood and with the conditions the way they were, it can preserve some of that sort of stuff. And we can still have it to this day, but lasting 65 million years. I mean, that's just, it's almost incomprehensible to think that something like that can last. One of the things that Mary Schweitzer described, you know, was, you know, they could actually smell it. It gave off a smell, which indicated that it was.
That's not something
pungent.
I want to smell. I'll take her word for it.
It gives off an odor. So, you know, it goes to show, you know, something was going on there a little bit more than what they thought.
All right, whatever your worldview is, if you are really going to take this that idea on scientifically, it is best served that you really open up and say, okay, what could it be? I mean, even if you're going to be a real honest creationist, you have to look at the evidence and say, well, could this be, you know, does the Bible really line up? When you do that, as you mentioned, you know, God hasn't lost an argument yet. God has not lost an argument yet. You can't be afraid of that, because you want to know that what you stand on is a solid, firm foundation. One other issue before I ask you another hard question where the Ark's concerned, Bodhi, is have we not found fossils or imprints of dinosaurs and humans next to each other? Is that a myth or is that a truth?
You know, I'm actually studying that right now because I'm working on a book where I'm dealing with a lot of those subjects. You know, so it's almost like you're preempting me. but, you know, there's been over 20 different trackways where people have claimed that there is some sort of a human or a dinosaur footprint there in the same layer. Now, as we look at that, most of those examples, I don't give a lot of credence to. I want people to understand that right up front. There are a few that are kind of disputed, but there are some that's definitely not. One of the things that we've seen, you know, there was a famous trackway down in Texas, down at the Flexi River. I've actually been down to the site. And, you know, there's something that kind of looks like human footprints and some dinosaur footprints in there. Now, those human-looking footprints, okay, you kind of look at this in the mud. As it would erode, into a three-toed footprint. So what you were seeing was this three-toed dinosaur stepping into the mud, pulling out, and keep going, and you're seeing the upper part of the leg there, and that kind of resembled a human footprint. So you have to be careful of stuff like that. So what I want to encourage people to do, whenever it comes to any of those types of trackways, it really needs to be researched, it needs to be documented in a peer review process. Yay. Let people battle it out.
Yes.
And do it right before we jump all over it.
The Bible says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. I quote that a lot in this age because we act as though science is settled in some ways. And then in other ways, it's like, well, you're a science denier. You know, stop it. Just debate it out. It's fine. Because in doing that, you really do get to the truth. Thank you for doing that. Thank you. Because, you know, it doesn't feel right to me to hear someone talk about, well, the Bible is true. And, you know, I heard this story. And so it becomes sensationalism to use a coin phrase, fake news. And so that's not something we want to do. So I want to ask another question of the improbability of the Ark. It's a desert area, people say. You know, where'd they find all of this gopher wood? Come on.
Okay, we got to think. Before the flood is a lot different than after the flood.
Yes.
So, when we look in the Middle East, the Ark, it landed in the mountains of Ararat, not necessarily Mount Ararat, but then people are arguing over what is Mount Ararat. There's ancient mountains called Mount Ararat that's different than what we call Mount Ararat today. But that's a different di discussion. But the point is, before the flood, it was much different. There's a lot more wood. It's a lot more lush. Like I said, Adam and Eve originally should have been able to fill the whole earth without wearing any clothes. So it's probably a much better climate altogether. Now, gopher wood. What exactly is gopher wood? Well, I guess you'd go for wood, right? I mean, that's the joke we all throw out there, right? It's probably an old joke. But gopher wood, people debate it. Is it a particular type of a tree? Think of a walnut tree or an oak tree as a particular type of tree, or is it the way the wood was worked? We have pressed wood and plywood, things like that. A lot of researchers think gopher wood is a way that it was processed and put together. A number of ancient ships that we pulled out of the Mediterranean Sea, they had these processing methods that was absolutely incredible. It blows our mind looking at it today, like, wow, that was pretty incredible the way they did that. We lost a lot of that technology over the years. But where did these ancients get that technology? Ark researcher Tim Lovett, he's one of them that helped design the Ark Encounter and the design that we have today. He did a lot of ancient ship research. And one of the things he suggested was, well, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. Shem lived 600 years, 500 of those years after the flood. So they were alive for a long time to pass on incredible shipbuilding techniques. And so he's thinking they passed on some of those techniques to some of these early ancients. And that's why some of these ancients had some pretty incredible ways of working the wood. And he thought, well, maybe that reflects the way it was done in Noah's Ark. And there's a lot of truth to that. That sure is possible. So I think I would probably lean more in the direction of the way the wood was processed as opposed to a particular type, but I don't think there would have been a problem finding any of it. There was probably plenty of wood around.
Well, we make this, it's a little bit embarrassing when we make these overreaching. Well, it's a desert area. You're not going to find wood. To think that the world has not changed in, almost, 6,000 years,
Right.
is a bit naive. But isn't it also a bit naive to think that you could fit every species of animal on the ark? I mean, the dimensions alone is one of the biggest critics of how all these animals fit on the ark. And I love asking you this question because it's like, yeah, I've heard it like a billion times.
I've heard it so much. I know Ken Ham has heard it so much that that's actually one of the chapters in our book, The Flood of Evidence. We actually did 40 chapters in this, and one of those chapters actually goes through how'd you fit those animals on board the ark. And there's a first off, let me clarify a couple of misconceptions that people have.
Yes.
The way we define animals today are species, okay? Species, the way it's defined today, is a modern mess up. There's actually a huge problem called the species problem out in science. For example, there's a whole bunch of dog species. We got wolf species, coyote species, dingoes. Okay, but all these dogs can also interbreed with each other, which means technically there's only one kind. Now, notice I use the word kind versus the word species.
Yes.
Okay, the Bible uses the word kind. It's the Hebrew word mean. Basically, as a rule of thumb, if animals can breed together, they're part of the same kind. So Noah only required two dogs on board the ark, not all these, what we call species today, of different dogs. Those two dogs come off the ark as they go around to different parts of the world. Their genetic information is filtered, and we define them as a red wolf or a coyote or a dingo or a domestic dog or whatnot. But yeah, he only needed two on board the ark. So we're not taking all these, what we call modern day species on board the ark. We're taking all of the original kinds. Now, I know there might be Spanish listeners out there. The word in Spanish for kind is the word species. So that really confuses them because there's the modern name species, and then there's the Hebrew word mean, which is translated as species in a lot of Spanish Bibles. It's also in the Latin Vulgate. But those are basically two different definitions of the word species, in case we have people listening on that one, just to clarify. But, if you actually do the research on the kinds, they would fit easily on board the ark. If you take two of each kind, seven of the clean type, take those on board the ark. In fact, based on the dimensions of Noah's Ark, based on the research we did down at the Ark Encounter, all the animals in their cages would have fit on just one of the three decks on board Noah's Ark. So there's plenty of space to hold what needed to be on there.
Okay, so let's reiterate that. When we're looking at kinds, recently there was a study and articles written on the species within, talking about regressive DNA within kinds that show that one type of dog has all of the makeup of all the other kinds. And then environment, microevolution changes within time, develop. And so we have coyotes, we have chihuahuas, which some don't even consider dogs, but we won't go into that.
They look like rats.
I'm sorry, chihuahua owners. They can be precious. I get it.
Actually, I like chihuahuas.
Yeah, perch pooches. There lies within our that DNA that the ability for expansion, which I think is a brilliant design feature, because that gives you adaptability, not being doomed to, okay, I'm a hairless chihuahua and, you know, the climates of the earth or my environment has changed. Well, that's just it. I'm done. We have the ability to change. And I think that's spectacular. We see that ability. So within that, based on modern science, you're saying that just having two of each kind is absolutely plenty to replenish. So I think that's one of the biggest arguments.
Two would easily be enough to replenish all these different kinds. On the earth afterwards, you know, there's considerable variability within those genetics. There's also, you know, the ways you can turn on and off certain genes and things, and that triggers certain things. Some are dominant, some are recessive. So there's a lot of things going on in there to give a lot of variability. It's a fascinating subject, actually, when you think about it, because yes, God designed these original creatures to be able to survive in the world. He knew there was going to be a flood. He knew they'd have to survive it and come around. So that's not a problem for an all-powerful God to be able to
recording in progress
in such a way. Now, also keep in mind, though, too, that God is the one who designed the original environment. And even after the flood, through the flood, God is still involved in designing those environments. So, you know, there's a lot of aspects that sometimes people want to leave God out of that. But no, God has been intimately involved on both sides of that equation. So that's pretty fascinating when you think about it.
I like it. So we're going to go into part two of our interview with Bodhi Hodge as we talk about the likability or the of Noah's Ark to kids, but the incompatibility with science. We're seeing that it's not so. If you missed part one, we talked about likes. We just got through talking about the likes of kinds of animals, that within animals there's the ability for dogs to mutate or to become into wolves or sheep dogs. And so having those kinds, it's very easy to see how from that point of view, how all of the animals could fit on the ark. We've talked about changes in the environment and even signs throughout many, many hundreds of accounts in other cultures of the ark. And as we're talking about the ark, even the availability of wood, well, changes that have been even documented through science in the earth kind of account for what could be desert today may have been flourishing once. We know that we see that account biblically with Israel. I'm going to ask you what you have found in your years of study and your experience with the Ark. What are some of the most powerful criticisms, the ones that you went, whoa, that's interesting. Let's dig into that.
You know, years ago, I would say the number one argument people wanted to bring against the Ark was trying to fit all those animals on board the ark. And I know we've talked about that a little bit, but let me go back historically.
Okay.
Because, you know, researchers have studied this subject for a long time. Now, with the ark encounter, of course, we dove into it in a detail that I think very few have ever really done. But you go back in the past, there was a researcher named John Woodmerappy. He wrote a very technical book. And in that book, he used the smaller ark and the maximum number of animals to see if they would fit on board the ark. Now, the Bible gives dimensions for the ark, 300 by 50 by 30, but it's in cubits. And a lot of people have no idea what is a cubit. Well, a cubit is about elbow to fingertip. Now, in the Bible, there was actually two cubits. There was a shorter, a common cubit, and there was the older or the royal cubit, which was a cubit plus a hand breadth, had a little bit extra. So you had a long and a short cubit, basically. And different cultures had slightly variations on their cubits because, well, the king that was in charge, usually their cubit was the official cubit, at least during their reign. So you get these variations. Well, what John Woodmerappy did, he used the shorter cubit. So that way Noah's Ark is the shorter ark. Okay, so it's a smaller ark. And then he wanted to put the maximum number of animals on board the ark. So what he did, instead of doing a family level, think order, family, genus, and species, right? Most of the kinds equate closer to a family level. There are exceptions. You know, the elephant kind goes up to an order. There's others that go down to a genus. What he decided to do is, well, let's just take them all at a genus level. So we're going to bring a massive number of animals on board the ark. And with that calculation, he had just under 16,000 animals that he was now going to try to fit on board this ark. And he brought fresh food and he brought fresh water on board the ark. The Bible didn't say anything about the water. They could have possibly harvested it. They were in a flood, of course.
Yeah, but there was no shortage there. Okay, I'll give you that.
And here's what he found. 74% of that ark, 74% of it was used to hold the animals, the food, and the water for a maximum number of them. So they would easily fit on board the ark. So I would say that right there was probably the biggest argument that the secularists brought for a long time. Once John Woodmerappy's research came out and they became familiar with it, they're like, okay, fine, you can fit the animals on the ark. But then they
Didn't happen.
Yeah, what they want to do is they say, well, there's no way this little square, looks like a rectangular ark could possibly survive the flood. Well, now everything suddenly shifted. They started looking at the structure of Noah's Ark. And then all of a sudden, we started seeing people research that. There was a Korean study done by a lot of people. Most of the people involved in the study, I think, were non-Christians. I know the head of it was a non-Christian. And they looked at the length, width, and height, the dimensions of Noah's Ark. And they said, is this stable? Is this a good structure? Is it bad? And they found that it was right in between. Okay, think of a triangle here. Right in between strength, stability, and comfort. The Ark sat right in the middle. It was incredible. And it makes sense why all these ocean-going vessels, throughout history and even modern times, use the same ratio of Noah's Ark, something very similar to it, in their ocean-going vessels. So that right there solved part of it. But then they said, but if the Ark is rectangular, those sharp corners right there, boy, the water's going to hit it. It's going to start leaking right at those corners. And so then researchers like Tim Lovett stepped in and said, well, you're right. You know, Noah's Ark, you know, it was a ship. It probably didn't just look like a rectangle, right? So he started rounding those corners. And the question is, how much do you round it? And look at some of the other features, the window, a bow fin, things like that, that a lot of ancient ships had. And that's where he came up with what we call the Lovett design. That's what the Ark Encounter looks like. It's based on the Lovett design. You can see it rounded, and be able to naturally take the wind and the waves, which certain ancient ships were able to do. So we've pretty much answered most of those questions people have about Noah's Ark. And I'm still struggling to find some that are really tough about it, at least at this stage.
Well, I think that there's a host of other fascinating questions that arise from that. When you think of the intricate design. I mean, we look at it through modern science. We have thousands of years of learning. We have the wealth of all human knowledge in our hands. And so we could say, well, this design, you know, this, that. How did people just barely crawling out of caves and grunting at each other create such an extraordinary, right? I mean, you have to go, wait a minute, this is pretty advanced stuff. It shows a genius level to be able to understand that even if it was designs sent from God himself, still to be able to measure. I took woodworking in school, Bodie, and if it weren't for the guys in my class who kind of helped me a lot, I would not have passed it. I'm not stupid. You know, I mean, some who may be watching may say, well, but, you know, I'm just saying, you know, I couldn't even build, you know, a little box, let alone an ark. So it takes a level of understanding. And mm-hmm. I think that comes into play with this question that I wanted to ask you. The idea of Adam and Eve, one man, one woman. You know, we look at that today as like, you know, you have kissing cousins and people are going, ew, you know, come on, you're going to have mutant children. There's a problem there. But those two ideas kind of marry well in a biblical worldview, because if you were talking about a fallen world where everything came out from God's creation as, wow, this is good. I did good, is basically what God's saying. Yep, I did good. You're looking at mankind who were, and animals, in a perfect state, probably brilliant, healthy, maybe larger or more robust. We know as we've gotten healthier, mankind has gotten stronger, lived longer than, you know, 50, 100 years ago. So that, I think, comes into play in the Ark story as well, when people say, well, you can't have offspring breeding offspring.
Yeah, where do they get that idea, though? That's the problem. That actually comes from the Bible. You know, you're not supposed to marry your close relation. That comes from Leviticus chapter 18.
But yet they had to after the ark. So is that a contradiction? I mean, they had to after the ark. So
that's right. But notice, Adam and Eve lived before Leviticus chapter 18. Noah and his family, they lived before. Abraham lived before it. Abraham actually married his half-sister Sarah. Moses, his father, married his aunt Jochebed. You see, prior to Leviticus chapter 18, which was given by Moses after the Israelites came out of Egypt, that's when they said no more close intermarriage. But if we look at this from a big picture, Adam and Eve, they had perfect genetic strands. They should have been able to have children, and those children should have been able to have children with each other without very many genetic mistakes, okay? As sin and the curse, you know, the more we have that, every time we have a generation, we make more mistakes. That's what happens. You know, like my wife and I, our kids probably have more genetic mistakes than what we do. And so, you know, it moves forward.
I'm going to tell your kids that you called them a genetic mistake. I'm telling them.
They sure are. Man, I am not kidding you. And I could probably tell you where. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, my kids are better looking than me, so I don't know what's going on. But it really is neat when you think about this, because originally brothers and sisters can marry and they wouldn't have to worry about that. Now, if I were to go marry my sister, and I've got some great sisters, but that's just not going to happen in today's culture. I would probably have a lot of the same mistakes that my sister would. So if we have genetic defects, we can both send the same genetic defects to our children, and then it shows. Because a lot of times you get one set from your mom, one set from your dad. And if you have a bad one, a lot of times that one that's bad is masked by the good gene. So there's good reasons for that, but it wasn't until the time of Moses God said no more close intermarriage. But that's a biblical principle. You know, if we just all evolved from animals, well, animals, you know, they mate with their brothers and sisters all the time. So, you know, when the secular world says, oh, you shouldn't do that, well, they're borrowing from the Bible, and they may not realize that. But, you know, you said something there earlier, just, and this was a big point. We've been conditioned to think people back in the past were not very smart. They were cavemen. They were brutes that weren't very smart, because we've been taught that we evolved from animals and we weren't that smart a long time ago. But if you think about Adam or Jared or Methuselah or Noah, these guys are living like 900 years old. Okay. Now imagine if Isaac Newton or Thomas Edison lived 900 years. What kind of things could they have come up with? I mean, that just blows your mind. It's possible that culture leading up to the flood was very, very advanced, and we may not realize how advanced they really were. You know, when God said, hey, Noah, I want you to build this ark and make it out of wood, I wonder if Noah's response was, wood? Who does that anymore? You know, I mean, it could have been something like that. We've been trained to believe people in the past were very primitive and not that smart.
And that is unscientific. We need to be willing to ask what if, even if you are set in your faith, and I know this is going to sound controversial to some, but we don't question God. I'm not telling you to question what the Bible, you know, I am actually telling you to question what the Bible says, you know, say, yeah. Well, wait a minute, because a lot of sometimes what we come to believe is because man says, well, this is what God says. All right. I want to check it themselves. Look, in the Bible, there were these people called the Bereans. And, you know, apostles are going up there saying, hey, Jesus is risen. Jesus is Lord. Jesus rocks, right? And they're going, okay, that's cool and everything. Thank you very much. But we're going to just go back and we're going to look at the Bible and we're going to see if what you're saying really lines up. We have lost. And they were commended for that. They were like, that's how you do it. The Bible didn't say, okay, everyone, you're beheaded, you're out, you know, how dare you question? That sounds like another worldview, but we won't get into it right now. That was commendable. I think that we have lost that today to say, all right, this is a hard one. This is hard. And there's been a time in human history where Darwinism took off, this idea of science being, you know, an authority. Great. But there wasn't as many answers. Now the answers are just flourishing. And we see that the answers in Genesis lie really closely with the answers that we're seeing in science. Just never be afraid to question it.
Right. Don't be afraid to question it, but don't be afraid to look up the answer too. I've seen some people ask the question and they don't want to hear the answer. No, you need to be willing to get to that answer. Go back, check the scripture, see what it says. I love looking at the science to see these incredible confirmations of it. Just thinking of the ark, you know, there was a bow fin that we've got on our ark. It's that big, it looks like a big sail-like thing on one side of the ark, right? So the ark is up there floating. Now, there's a good reason for that. We've done scientific experiments on that. Tim Lovett would put this thing out there, and with the wind and the waves, it would keep the ark righted, pointed into the wind and the waves, even though it's getting pushed along because it's got that fin on there like that pulling it along. And what's fascinating about that is you don't want the ark to turn with the waves going like this, because you can go, you don't want that to happen. So having that on there, that was an incredible confirmation of that type of a design. Now, is that design absolute? No, but we've got some good scientific reasons for why that bow fin was on there and why Noah likely had that to help survive the flood. Nice. It really is cool stuff. I love seeing those confirmations. When we look at the science,
it's pretty exciting, actually. You can go to the Ark Encounter and experience a lot of what we've talked about. And I actually think that you should. This might be a really good year with everything else kind of closing down and closing up and denying people and you're kind of aren't welcome here. It might be a nice time to go and visit with your family. A lot more families, by the way, are homeschooling. Answers in Genesis have innumerable resources for homeschooling families. I think if we were to be honest, every parent that cares is a homeschooler, no matter where your children go to school, whether it's at the kitchen table or it's in a public schoolroom. You have to supplement if your kids are going to walk away with any knowledge at all other than, you know, I know critical race theory at some times. I mean, I know I'm being flip because there's great teachers out there that are teaching great things and are really, really
and they need
care.
The prayer. They need the prayer. If you think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So remember to go to Answers in Genesis. All of those links will be at mymichellelive.com, mymichellelive.com. There are so many other questions. You know, how did they navigate? And I'm thinking, where do you navigate? The whole world's flooded. You just float around and you hope that the faith that you had in God is really going to see you through, much like our lives. I mean, we build our lives based on a worldview. When we allow that worldview to be shaken, we go, okay, what is really true? And you hunker down and look for real truth. And if you are like me, you find truth in the Bible, and that's your comfort. That's your anchor. But there are times in life where you might be like, I'm thinking Noah, sometime out there is floating around, the world's destroyed. They're devastated. They had to have devastation.
And of course.
Thinking, okay, I really did hear from God, right? I'm sure his wife was like, are you sure you heard from God? I mean, are we going to be floating on this thing forever? You know, you think of that old stupid movie Waterworld. You know, that's the new reality. But that's where the rubber hits the road and you go, you know what? Either I'm going to believe or I'm not. And you know what, God, you've never failed me yet. That's my God story. And that's what I pull out of this story today. Bodhi, what you guys do there is so vitally important. Not afraid to ask the hard questions and not afraid to be lambasted by absolutely everyone as you do it. Talk about thick skin, man. I appreciate you.
Appreciate that. Hey, be praying for us. Pray for me. Pray for the ministry. We really appreciate that.
And we'll be hearing more from you as time goes on, because we like to geek out on the God story. Bodhi Hodge is with Answers in Genesis, and I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. God bless you, girl.
Now, you make sure that you like us, share us, because if the mainstream isn't going to dig deep into stories, well, those of us who are, and there's a lot of other voices that are trying to do what we're doing, you know, like us, share us, get the God story, especially out there, because it is a message of hope. So with that, thank you, and we'll catch you next time.
More SciTech Talk at MyMichelleLive.com.